Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. Today, discussing how COVID-19 is impacting mental health service providers and special needs service providers with Tina Spears. Tina Spears is the executive director of the Community Provider Network of Rhode Island. And look, we're seeing significant spikes in the COVID numbers here in the Ocean State over the last week. And it's pretty obvious, not only are we in phase two here, but we are obviously well into phase two. We just got a warning just today from Governor Raimondo, who was flanked by three medical doctors from different hospitals around the state that said, we're dangerously close to using the field hospitals, perhaps overwhelming the healthcare system. And the governor hinted for the first time, really since the spring, of a lockdown that may be coming if we don't somehow find a way to dial in the COVID numbers. So always staying on top of that on a day-to-day basis over on the Facebook group, which you can access at btown.stream, on Twitter and Instagram, at Bill Bartholomew, and you can send me a message anytime, bill@ripodcast.com. I'm also on the radio this week. I'll be there. This obviously is being released on a Friday, so if you're listening to this on release day, I'll be on the air from 9 to noon on WPRO, 99.7 FM, AM 630, and taking calls and kind of doing a live chat about COVID in Rhode Island and how it's, once again, a situation where the numbers are creeping up, the hospitalizations are creeping up, the severe outcomes are creeping up, and we are getting into dangerous territory. So no question about it. Look, we've been through this together all year, and all we know is that we've got to keep persevering, and there are some basic things we can do to try to mitigate the impact of this virus. You know, obviously the masks and all that business and quarantining when appropriate, keeping the groups down, all that stuff. But I think there's also a state of mind that you can have, which is that we've been through some significant challenges together as a human species, right? And we're in the thick of one right now. We may be entering an age of pandemic. We've heard that conversation. We may be entering an age of climate change, we are in an age of climate change, but an age in which climate change starts to impact our physical environment. So we've got to start to find systems, find ways to move past this dichotomy of us versus them and get to a point where we can embrace innovation, expertise, and each other. And I know that seems a little bit like getting up on the soapbox, which I don't tend to do on the podcast too much. That's more more straight to the point here. But hey, look, we've got to do it right now or else we're going to be in some significant trouble. All right, today's episode, it focuses in on one acute area of care which has been significantly impacted by COVID-19, and that is the service providers for mental health and those with special needs. And we talked to Tina Spears of the Community Provider Network of Rhode Island about this issue and where it's at and where it may be going, the needs of that particular community. So trying to highlight some of the acute areas, as we've done throughout the year in Bartholomew Town, that COVID-19 is impacting, and we do so again today. Bartholomew Town is a listener-supported program. There's a few ways that you can help sustain this operation. One is to just simply share this episode wherever you like to do so, on Facebook or other social media apps. You can also leave a rating and review wherever you're listening right now. And if you want to go a step further, you can hit the support button or head to patreon.com/Bartholomew Town, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the independent journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that we've become known for here in the Ocean State. For $10 per month, you may become a B-Town insider, where you'll receive exclusive monthly content. That's patreon.com/Bartholomew Town. All right, let's get right to it. A conversation with Tina Spears. COVID-19 in Rhode Island, obviously, first and foremost, there's the health challenges, but then right there, kind of, you know, 1A, 1B in terms of assessing this are the equity challenges. And we've seen some strides being made to address that from a brick and mortar standpoint. And we've seen some strides to address it from, I guess, a programming standpoint as well, but there are still major gaps. So why don't you give us sort of an overview of your world in the COVID-19 era and how that translates into the people that you serve?
Okay, great. So I would say COVID-19 has pretty much flipped our service delivery model upside down and changed how we deliver services pretty much on a dime. So we went from a community-based service model where, you know, we made every attempt to support someone fulfilling their life goals, which is, you know, ranges from, you know, just day-to-day learning skill building to supporting them in career placement. So, you know, that being said, those service delivery models had to significantly shift from promotion of community inclusion to really kind of retraction and safety measures. Yeah. And when we did that, when COVID hit, we had to pretty much shut down any day service models that we were conducting on a regular basis and really shift our workforce and our operations to those individuals that we support on a 24-hour basis, which are people that live in congregate care settings, also known as group homes. We call them homes because many of these individuals live here and they've forged strong partnerships and relationships with the people they live with, as well as the professionals that they work with. So we moved, you know, move away from community. We really had to focus on safety and preventative measures, intervention measures. And that took quite some time, I have to say. The nation was caught off guard. Certainly Rhode Island was no different. There was a lot of systems that weren't in place. There was a lot of misconceptions about our population and what they needed and what risk level they were at. So we as organizations really advocated strongly. It took some time to get the administration's attention and focus on this work, but ultimately we succeeded and did get the types of supports that we needed, probably I would say within 6 to 8 weeks of the onset of COVID.
So where do you stand now today? And we're taping in early September. This will probably, mm-hmm. This is airing sometime in early fall. Where do we stand now today as far as that relationship between the state and administrators and your needs on a fundamental basis?
So also, that's a good question. I would say it's strong. Our direct line of communication with the Division of Developmental Disabilities is very strong. There's never been a situation where we were not in alignment of what needed to occur. Operationalizing it are two different questions there. We did struggle to get things operationalized. I would say it's very strong with the division. What I will say is we're building stronger relationships with the Department of Health, which is really our public health entity that's really driving a lot of policies that really impact us as organizations in the population we serve. And as far as the governor's office and at the administrative level, we are strengthening that relationship as well to really be forward thinking, find solutions, changes that need to be made on a long term scale. So I would say it's improving. I wouldn't say it was ever bad, but it was certainly not strong. So we're consistently working towards strong partnership with the state.
That's something that is broadly coming up here in COVID, which is, all right, we've had whatever sector we're talking about, education, mm-hmm. health equity, distribution of resources, interaction with communities of immigrants, whatever it may be, finding, okay, how can we use this moment in time to not only get back to the old normal, but, you know, we hear this new normal over and over again. That new normal should be an improved version of each sector that we're dealing with in any case. Do you feel like post-COVID, the relationships that you're forging now are drawing attention to the actual needs that that are required to serve the communities that you serve in a better way than you were before COVID? Is that a possibility?
I think so. I'm optimistic, and I'm always the eternal optimist, and I drive towards improvement and solutions. That's always been how I approach dialogue with any partner. And that's not different with the state, right? So I think the governor is extraordinarily focused on the economy and changing systems in the state of Rhode Island. What I think sometimes is lacking in approach is really understanding the population that's served by this, or understanding some industries that maybe are underneath the system that you don't realize are really having significant impact on your community, on your economy, and on the community itself. So I think yes, there's a ton of opportunity here. I think it's incumbent upon us as advocacy organizations and as service providers to make sure we're communicating very clearly and deliberately with what we need and where we want to go for the interests of the people that we support. So I will say for our industry, I think the administration and, you know, policymakers in general, I think we need to speak a different language about what we do, how we do it, and who's impacted by it. So we're changing that dialogue. We're also saying there is a significant, this COVID has unleashed all the inequities in our system. We see it. It's clear. People can't deny it. And for the disability community in our workforce, it's even more apparent than ever. It's something we've been talking about for a very long time. We've been trying to raise awareness around our population as well as our workforce. But I think now we can really make the case that the people that we support are marginalized in our community. So let's fix that problem. And then two, the people that work to support inclusion in the community for people with disabilities are marginalized. Let's fix that problem.
That is so interesting and disturbing. Discover over 200 episodes of Rhode Island's podcast of record, the Bartholomew Town Podcast, on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your pods. Or head over to our website, ripodcast.com. Earlier in the crisis, I was focusing in on CNAs, who I had some on, and even nurses, frankly, who, you know, but there, I had one nurse on who cried during the broadcast here because the description of what workers were facing in hospitals and the fact that many of these folks who were providing a baseline of really support for people who are getting sick or trying to prevent people in hospitals from acquiring COVID or getting worse, whatever it may be. A lot of those people were leaving their 8-hour shift and going and driving Uber just so they could put food on the table. So it shows that we need to wake up and realize when we rebuild society, we need to really prioritize healthcare workers, advocacy workers in a way that's way more meaningful. Not just a pat on the back, but in some cases, just the ability to survive at a base level. I mean, that is absolutely outrageous that we've got essential workers that are working second jobs, not so they can, you know, buy goods and services, but so they can have their fundamental needs met. I mean, that is outrageous.
Yeah. And I have to say, so there's some big policy issues here, right? There's some really systemic issues that have driven that scenario, right? I think about 10, 15 years ago, people in the health and human service industry, that was a middle-class job, or potentially. It no longer is. And why is that? I think the questions need to be asked. Why? So what I can tell you is Medicaid reimbursement rates and insurance reimbursement rates, which drive most of your health and human service industry, which is your CNA work, which is your DSP work that we do. There is an imbalance between what we can get reimbursed for those services, for those wages, and what is provided in the community. The value add to this industry in our community is paramount. Like, people need to recognize that if there's 300,000 Rhode Islanders that in some way, shape, or form are benefiting from Medicaid-provided services, the industry needs to match that. If that's a huge portion or sector of our society that relies on that infrastructure, then the people that support that infrastructure need to be equally valued. And there is a huge workforce correlation to this. And that's the argument that we're making to the governor, that there's an opportunity here. If you have this many low-wage workers in this industry, why would we want them to be low-wage workers? Why wouldn't we want them to be middle-class workers? Why wouldn't we want them to have a living wage and be reflective of the work that they're providing? They're skilled. Everyone who provides health and human services are skilled. They go through extensive training. They have high expectations. There's a standard that we set to say, you must do this in order to do this work. We need to compensate that. It should not be comparable to somebody who is, and this is not in any way disparaging that work, somebody who goes and does retail or does some other meaningful job, but does not have to get professionalized in the way that this industry does. So yeah, there shouldn't be a correlation between those two jobs and pay. And that's what we're fighting for, is that it just needs to absolutely change.
It's an absolute disgrace. And I think that if you had the governor here on this call or any elected official, there's no way that they wouldn't disagree with that. No. It's just, how do we, what are the steps? So there's, of course, inside the halls of government, which of course with the General Assembly not in session, it's difficult to make any maneuvers there. But we've seen a lot of distribution of, you know, printed money, whatever it may be, the $2.5 trillion in stimulus, whatever it may be. What are the mechanics that you think right now should be implemented to adjust wage and to, in turn, theoretically or probably certainly improve services in terms of DSP or just in broadly in, let's just say, social services?
So I would say that there needs to be an investment in the infrastructure of many of the organizations that provide this service. Yeah. There's a little bit of a disconnect between what it takes to operate one of these organizations and, you know, the payment structure. So there's got to be some kind of investment in those organizations that are providing the service to the community. But regardless of that, I think that there's an investment strategy here with the workforce to say you're retooling it and you're revamping how you deliver supports in the community. You would have to redesign the payment structure of the Medicaid delivery system, as well as set some benchmarks for your insurers. So if their reimbursement rates, you know, there's policies, right? So insurers have an 80% they have to spend on their medical spend. But when they are delivering or providing a rate to a provider, are there any controls in place to say that that rate is actually covering the cost of delivering that service? I would argue that in the commercial world, providers that have, I would say, a little more juice than the home and community provider networks would have, they're radiologists, they're specialists, they're, you know, surgeons. They can negotiate rates that cover their costs and provide a very robust salary for their workers. And rightly so, they should have adequate for professional skill. Where are the controls here? Where's the negotiating power for that home and community-based network to ensure that there's access and to ensure that they are reimbursing providers so they can provide equitable wages? So I think that there's some big systemic issues there. But certainly I think the governor at this point can make it a priority to say that this industry is valued and we're going to ensure, I mean, women, they're predominantly women. I think most reports would say they're about 70% women. Mm-hmm. And I know in my own industry from some recent surveys, you know, anywhere from 40 to 60% of our workforce is also minorities. So why wouldn't we address that inequity issue and make sure that we elevate those worker wages? So I think you could structurally, you know, in her Back to Work initiative, there's lots of ways that you can get to living wages and then elevate tracks of training and professionalization in these industries. So you can potentially flatten some of the organizations so people can gain stronger skills over time and can do more for an organization. But you got to invest. You got to invest in that workforce.
Last question. What kind of lobbying on a long-term scale post-COVID, where do you see, again, back inside the halls of the General Assembly? You know, we have our educational, our post-secondary education situation, for lack of a better term, with respect to CCRI, with respect to URI, even RIC. There's going to be a lot of retraining. Let's face it. You know, there's going to be a lot of folks who are going to need to adjust their careers because whether they're in the entertainment industry or the broad events industry, or they realized that the fallout from a situation like COVID-19 makes it such that their current job or role is unsustainable. When there's a great need in social services, broadly speaking, again, what can be done to kind of lobby inside the General Assembly for packages, legislation that would allow for free retraining for people? So once those wages are raised, there would be a demand for those jobs, but also to just further encourage people who right now may be thinking about a career change that are qualified mentally and physically to do the work, but just connecting that dot of getting people into that workforce simultaneously with wage increases.
Yeah, that's the challenge, right? You have to do both simultaneously. The demand's there, no doubt about it. Yeah. Every single one of my organizations has a vacancy rate. Demand's there. But can we tie the wage to the demand? To the infusion or the pipeline into the work. So we have currently, we're working with CCRI on an apprentice project to retain workers, right? So we have to build out the system. We have to build the understanding of what it is, build up the skill level and entry into, and provide competent wages. And then third is the retention strategy. I think, again, back to my original conversation, is we, myself, need to communicate to the General Assembly and to the Governor's office really succinctly about, we're an industry, we need to strengthen it. We need to support it for our community, for the betterment of it, and our policies and investments need to line up. So I would say that there has to be an investment in the health and human service space on training, pipeline building. The governor's on it. It's definitely her thing, right? DLT is trying to work on that with real jobs, pathways. I think strong investment there that line up, but we have to fix the problem on the back end, which is the wages have to marry. You can't drive people to an industry where you're subjecting them to poverty wages. So that has to stop.
I could not agree more. I mean, you said it so on the nose there. And a lot of people, and I even made a comment earlier this year to a state representative on an earlier episode of this podcast, where, you know, I said, hey, look, you know, we've got folks who are the driving force of getting us through this pandemic, who are making poverty wages, and no real plan to when this pandemic is over, which I do believe we will, through our own ingenuity globally, find a way out of this. But we can't leave behind the same folks that are now suffering through incredibly unfair wages. I mean, let's face it, there's no way. And you can have the opinion that we should move in a capitalistic direction. You can have the opinion that we should move in a more socialistic direction or somewhere in between, whatever the case may be. Any kind of system of organization of humans should not leave behind those who provide care. It's fundamentally flawed. Even in an anarchy situation, you would assume that those caretakers are provided for. So this is as backwards as it gets.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's really puzzling to me how it happened over time, how the care of our most vulnerable have been left behind, like the wages and the value of that industry and that workforce. But we have an opportunity. So I'm an internal optimist. It can be done. And there's an economic argument here that I think has been unspoken, which is, The more you raise wages, the more you get in revenue, the more you get in sales tax, the more you get in federal dollars. So if we're raising those Medicaid wages, Medicaid rates, we're drawing down more federal dollars, more dollars going into our state. We're increasing, if you increase the wage to hit a sweet spot where that person's contributing more to the community, there's revenue. So there's an offset of your investment on the Medicaid front end, which is your state match. There's a whole host of reasons why it makes sense, and particularly in a space where some industries aren't going to survive this. The health and human service industry has to survive this. We cannot move from the position of, you know, community-based services, which is everyone's right, and it's by law, we must do it, to institutional care, which costs more, and you're required to provide service to these people. So there's 10,000 reasons why they must do it for the right reasons, but it also makes sense from an economic perspective. So I think the argument needs to be made. We need to be strong about it and forceful. And that's going to be our number one priority this year, is to really stabilize this industry, stabilize this workforce, and communicate the value. Because if we do anything else, that's what is our primary objective this year. So we'll be lobbying the State House. We'll be communicating strongly with the governor's office, as well as, you know, with the public, because the public, I know the public supports us, but sometimes I think we do a good job of hiding our challenges. They don't really know what could happen if we don't succeed.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.